This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. Alan Lomax traveled the world for decades with his reel-to-reel, recording the sounds of everyday people. He considered it the responsibility of archivists to bring the unheard into the public sphere. Artists like Leadbelly, Muddy Waters, and Woody Guthrie were relatively unknown until the Lomax recordings. Needless to say, our nation's understanding of folk music owes much to Alan Lomax. UNC Chapel Hill's Southern Folklife Collection is now celebrating his legacy in the American South. This Friday, the collection will host the symposium, The Southern Journey of Alan Lomax. To discuss that journey, we're joined today by Bill Ferris. He's Senior Associate Director of the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC. Bill, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
And on the line is Nathan Salzberg. He's the curator for the Alan Lomax Archive at the Association for Cultural Equity. Nathan, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks a lot.
So we'll hear some of Lomax's recordings in just a moment. But first, Bill, who was Alan Lomax? Describe what he did.
Well, he was really a cultural phenomenon. He basically, more than any other individual person, gathered massive collections of music, archived them at the Library of Congress, and essentially made America aware of this rich tradition of music and made Americans understand that this was part of their cultural heritage that was unique and invaluable.
And he got his start with his father, John Lomax, recording cowboy songs. Is that right?
That's right. His father was from Texas and was drawn to cowboy songs, which he carried with him to Harvard University when he studied there with George Lyman Kittredge, a Shakespeare and ballad scholar. And Kittredge encouraged John Lomax to go back to Texas and to continue to make these recordings that he eventually published in a major book called Cowboy Songs. And that effort expanded as he began to travel more broadly, and he carried his teenage son, Alan, with him. So Alan began this at an early age and literally did it all his life.
And it's interesting that it would be a Shakespeare scholar at Harvard who would really encourage this work, because these types of recordings, cowboy songs in Texas, weren't always accepted by the Academy as sort of a real, as valuable work. Is that right?
That's right. The connection was that Kittredge was a ballad scholar and was drawn to the ballad, the song that tells a story that's richly represented in both the British Isles and in America. So he understood that these cowboy songs were in that tradition and that they were vital living examples of a music that he had studied all his academic career. So his counterpart at Columbia University was Franz Boas, whose student there was Zora Neale Hurston, whom he sent back to her home in Eatonton, Florida, to record her collections. And she and Alan actually worked together on projects. So you have these two great universities, Harvard and Columbia, sending students back home to Texas and to Florida to create a legacy of sound.
And Nathan, they weren't going to, you know, concert halls to record performances. They were going to really what we might consider out-of-the-way places. Describe some of the places they did seek out to record and why they went there.
One of John A. Lomax's earliest interests was in the music that could be found in the southern penitentiaries, the prison farms. And in 1933, he and 17-year-old Alan made their first recordings at the Huntsville Penitentiary in Texas and at Angola, the Louisiana State Prison Farm. And the idea was, John A. Lomax's idea was that some of the oldest strains of antebellum black song could be found in the prisons that had been, you know, largely insulated by the radio and by changing black culture in the juke joints and on the stage. And what they found there, by and large, was a music that had been somewhat preserved from the days of some slavery days, the songs of the field holler, the solo voice complaint, and changed in a work song, a work gang setting with axes and hoes, folks clearing the bottom lands or chopping down timber. And they had created a whole tradition of work song specific to the Southern Penn experience. And this was a huge revelation for 17-year-old Alan. You can imagine he was hearing music that was existed only in this site and was basically, as he said later to Charles Carroll, you know, he had heard the best jazz and the best orchestras, the best chamber music, and he said this was the greatest American music he could imagine.
Well, let's hear a bit of what he was talking about. This is a clip of one of Alan Lomax's prison recordings. This is the song Go Down, Old Hannah.
Go down, old Hannah. If you ride, drink judgment on me. Lord, if you ride, drink judgment on
me. That's one of Alan Lomax's prison recordings, Go Down, Old Hannah. Nathan, tell us a little bit about that clip.
Alan, that is the particular recording that Alan said later was this the most beautiful song he'd basically ever heard in the American tradition, and I believe that was recorded at the Huntsville Farm in Texas. And this music, as Bill said, for Alan was and there's another great story, if I may. He recalls making an early prison recording with his father, and they turned the disc recorder on and said, you know, we're making a recording for the Library of Congress. They'll hear you in Washington. The president will hear your song. They turn the machine on, and the man looks into the microphone and says, "Hello, Mr. President," and no response, of course. And the Lomaxes say, "What are you waiting for?" And he said, "Well, I was waiting for him to hello me back." And the idea was that here was finally a means of giving a voice to the voiceless, a means of representing an underclass, an untouchable class that had never, you know, heretofore been documented, certainly not by the Library of Congress, not, you know, with the funds of the American government, of the American taxpayer. And that, I think, affected Alan deeply and guided his work for the next six decades.
And he didn't necessarily, therefore, want to do this type of field work for the same reason that his father did.
No, his father, I think it's safe to say, was a romantic. I think he was sort of seeking music that, and, you know, he was very much a Southern gentleman, and he was a complex figure, certainly. I mean, he was, although he, there were certain racist elements that would have been unavoidable, you know, in a Texan born in the 1860s, he was known to take African-American voters to their polling places, you know, obviously against probably the better wishes of his society that he kept. But he was interested in sort of preserving, you know, an antebellum song, Happier Days of the South, and a South that he remembered fondly as a child. Alan was much more interested in preserving the songs of underclasses. And one of the earliest collections of recordings he and his father made were actually in eastern Kentucky in 1933 in Harlan County. This is the first time that Alan recorded any white folk song, and would be the first for several years. And his interest was in what was happening there in terms of agitation for the UMWA, the coal miner union, something that his father looked askance at. But Alan, from a very early age, realized that celebrating this music was celebrating the people who made it. And he considered himself a progressive, and of course, come 1940, got wrapped up in the community in New York, the People's Songs Collective, as it was called, which was included Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, who would, of course, later get wrapped up in the McCarthy era and be blacklisted.
So, Bill, it seems like Alan Lomax really, you know, changed the way that we could think about the place of a folk music collector in society. Mm-hmm. Would that be fair?
It's very fair. I think of Alan's gift to the Library of Congress of recorded music as equivalent in value to the gift of Thomas Jefferson's books. These are foundation resources, one printed books, the other recorded sound, and they are both fundamental to the American experience, and one cannot imagine America today without understanding Alan Lomax and his extraordinary life.
And what kind of influence did Lomax have on the careers of Southern musicians? I mean, who were some of the musicians we know of perhaps because of Lomax?
Well, one in particular is Mississippi Fred McDowell, whom I recorded in 1968. And I had heard him on Allen's earlier work. And when I was with Mr. McDowell, he told me that he had stopped playing music until Allen found him and recorded him. And because of that experience, he picked up his guitar and renewed his career as a musician and is one of the truly great bottleneck blues singers in history.
Well, and we're going to hear some of Mississippi Fred McDowell and talk a bit more about him after we take a short break here on The State of Things. Bill Ferris, a Senior Associate Director of the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC. Nathan Salzberg is the Curator of the Alan Lomax Archive at the Association for Cultural Equity. And just ahead, we will continue our conversation on the work of Alan Lomax and hear more of his archival recordings. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. Today we're talking about the renowned folklorist Alan Lomax and his legacy in the American South and beyond. Bill Ferris is Senior Associate Director of the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC, and Nathan Salzberg is the Curator for the Alan Lomax Archive at the Association for Cultural Equity. They both join me today. And let's go right to some music. We were speaking before the break about Mississippi Fred McDowell, and we have an excerpt here from an Alan Lomax recording of one of his songs, Going Down to the River.
I'm going down to the river, I'm going to kill my rocking chair. Going down to the river, I'm going to take my rocking chair.
So, Bill Ferris, tell us a little bit about Mississippi Fred McDowell.
Well, Mississippi Fred McDowell lived in the community of Gravel Springs, Mississippi, in the northeast quadrant of Mississippi in the hills. We think of the blues in the Delta, but there's a very important bottleneck tradition in the area of northeast Mississippi that inspired also the fife and drum music of Othar Turner. And Alan Lomax repeatedly went back to this community. He found it a kind of primal sound that he was drawn to, the fife and drum, the bottleneck style. And interestingly, Fred McDowell's music is the inspiration of Bonnie Raitt's bottleneck style, and she acknowledges his importance in her growth as a young musician. But Fred McDowell is considered the heartbeat of that sound, and the North Mississippi All-Stars, Cody and Luther Dickinson, today model much of their music on this tradition. So for close to 75 years, Fred McDowell has been shaping each generation of music in the Deep South.
And it's fascinating because, you know, anyone who knows blues music now knows of Mississippi Fred McDowell. And yet, as you were saying just a moment ago, he said that he had stopped playing until Alan Lomax found him, if you will.
He found him. He rediscovered him. He brought him to the stage of the Newport Folk Festival. Allen was not only recording, but he was an impresario. He was bringing people to festival stages, to stages in theaters. He was a great lover of radio and understood the power of radio to reach people over broad distances. He was a modern person who embraced every generation of technology and sadly did not live to see the internet, but he dreamed it was coming with his global jukebox vision, which today is a reality, but he was bridging every step of the way this sound of folk music with new technology.
And I want to come back in a moment and talk about that global jukebox project. But I do first want to ask Nathan Salzberg, you know, this the discovery of Mississippi Fred McDowell took place during what, you know, we sort of now refer to, I suppose, as Alan Lomax's Southern Journey, this period from 1959 to 1960. Tell us about that.
The Southern Journey was actually speaking specifically about what Bill mentioned technology-wise and Alan's impresario nature. In 59 and 60, Alan had just returned from 8 years abroad in England, Ireland, Spain, Italy, making extensive recordings for the BBC and for RAI, Italian radio and TV. And he came back to find in New York City that there was a folk revival underway, the urban folk revival, the great folk scare, as they called it, in Washington Square Park in New York City. And he, while he appreciated the interests a lot of young musicians were taking in the music, a lot of which was recorded by himself and his father, he was worried that they were thinking that the music itself, you know, the font from which it sprung, was no longer, you know, extant. So he decided that he would go south, and he actually went with the sponsorship of Atlantic Records, who had had a big summer in 59 with singles by Ray Charles and the Drifters, and they gave him a stereo tape machine. It was the first stereo tape machine used in a field recording capacity. And Lomax had been to the Mississippi Delta in 41 and 42, made the first recordings of Muddy Waters and Honey Boy Edwards then, made the first recordings of the great Sun House 11 years after he made his very slight commercial recordings for the Paramount label in 1930. So he wasn't really interested in looking for blues. And when he was in the Hill Country in late 59, it was October 59, he had recorded the multi-instrumentalist Sid Hemphill, who was sort of called the patriarch of the Hill Country. He played the quills, the cane, the cane panpipes. He played the fife and had a fife and drum band. He played the banjo and the fiddle. And he played, he made recordings from this phenomenal group called the Young Brothers, who were a fife and drum group. Lomax was the first one to record fife and drum music in 1942. And one of the Young Brothers, a guy named Lonnie Young, his neighbor ambled over one evening with a guitar and overalls, and Shirley Collins, the great English folk singer who was Lomax's traveling companion on the 59 leg of the Southern Journey, later recalled in her book that they sort of resented the intrusion of this younger musician. Here they were recording this music that went back deep into the 19th century, really old-time black country dance music. But when he started to play, of course, this was Fred McDowell, they realized they were in the presence of a master musician.
Hmm. Now, I am curious, you mentioned his long sojourn before that abroad, and did in some of those recordings that he was doing for the BBC, I mean, did he trace some of the music back even further, if you will? I mean, he was tracing, of course, American music back to its roots here in the U.S. Did he then trace it back further to overseas?
Meaning the music specifically he was recording in England and Ireland?
Yeah.
Well, he was really interested in actually in a ballad tradition as he had experienced it in the work of course, Francis James Child and Cecil Sharp in the American South from the 1880s through the 19-teens. But he was really interested in what was happening in terms of, you know, what we might call survivals in the American South, but that this music was still, in fact, thriving in its native habitats in Ireland and England and Scotland, that it was being sung at the pubs. There were ballads and work songs being sung at work, women walking the Tweed and the Hebridean Isles of Scotland, or farmers in England, the great Bothy ballads of Lowland Scotland, sung by the migrant workers in the fields. So what he was finding was no sort of anachronistic holdover, but a living tradition, and I think that really inspired him to do the further work that he did in Spain and in Italy, massive recording trips, and sort of done just at the right time, because under the fascist influence in Spain and Italy, a lot of this music was sort of being homogenized and turned into the kind of fairly boring stuff that was being pumped out in the after-work activities, committees, meetings of, you know, various fascist musicians and fascist musicians, music groups that were put together for the diversion of the working classes.
Well, speaking of ballads, let's hear a bit of one now from right here in North Carolina. In fact, we have a piece from Sheila K. Adams, a ballad singer from Madison County.
Raining, it's pouring, the rain is pouring down. If I can't have my dime, I'll have no one in town. I'll have no one in town. I'll have no one in town.
Now, Bill Ferris, Alan Lomax did some work right here in North Carolina, as we just heard.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Alan had an instinct for good music. He could hear a good performer and know they were of value and significant, although they had never been recorded. And so in North Carolina, he did what he had done in Texas and Mississippi and overseas. He recorded with his heart, and the recordings he made here are part of a compendium. Most of his best-known work was in the Deep South, because that is where he and his father had their roots. The Lomaxes were from Mississippi. As his father wrote, they were the upper crust of the po-white trash who moved in an ox-drawn cart from Goodman, Mississippi, to Texas. So they instinctively went to those Deep South worlds. But along the way, they traveled in North Carolina, in Appalachia, and wherever musicians were doing good music, they recorded.
And Nathan Salzberg, I gather that maybe part of the reason that Alan Lomax didn't do too much work here in North Carolina is that that North Carolina was a place where some of this work was already being done. Is that right?
I think that's the case. I'm not sure, but what I surmise is that, you know, going back to the time of Francis James Child, you know, compiling his Child ballad volumes, back to the late part of the 19th century in North Carolina, Cecil Sharp and Maud Carpelli's came again in the 19-teens. And then in the 20s, some of the earliest disc recordings and cylinder recordings were made in North Carolina by the one fellow named Robert Winslow Gordon, who was the first person to record music for the Archive of Folk Song at the Library of Congress, and a very undersung fellow named Lawrence Gellert, who worked sort of in isolation and in recording music specifically in prisons and by African-Americans in their communities. He made a lot of recordings in Tryon in 1925. And, of course, the great Bascom Lamar Lunsford, the lawyer banjo player from South Turkey Creek, North Carolina, who ran the Appalachian Folk Festival. He did a lot of work, of course, putting these things on the stage. So Lomax only recorded a few times in North Carolina leading up. John A. Lomax made a number of recordings in the late 30s, but Alan Lomax, I think his first North Carolina recordings were made during the Southern Journey, and they were made in Concord in late 59. They were actually the last recordings made on the 59 leg of the trip, and they were of J.E. Maynor, one of the two great Maynor boys who made so many wonderful records in the 1930s and 40s on 78 RPM, one of the earliest sort of bluegrass string bands to record in that sort of halcyon era, when music started to speed up and sound a little more like the bluegrass we understand today.
Let's go back and talk a little bit about the folk revival that you mentioned that was already underway when Alan Lomax came back from overseas, and then he went on this southern journey from 59 to 60. Nathan, talk a little bit about the interplay there, how Lomax's work fueled the folk revival, but also how that experience led him to push for royalties for the musicians he recorded.
Sure. Well, we don't have time to get into the very complex relationship between Leadbelly and the Lomaxes, but suffice it to say that Leadbelly sort of made his or became famous in the 1930s, performing by and large for urban audiences in places like New York City and Washington, D.C. And the Lomaxes helped Leadbelly get a recording contract for the ARC label, made a number of records in the mid to late 30s, and by the time of 1939, 1940, he had taken up with a community in New York, including the principals who would go on to found the Weavers, the great sort of proto-folk revival group of the 1940s led by Pete Seeger and Ronnie Gilbert. And Leadbelly and Woody Guthrie and Pete, of course, their music inspired so many generations of folk revivalists from the 1940s through the through the present, really. But Lomax realized in the 1930s, 1938 to be exact, he undertook 8 hours of oral history recordings with the great Jelly Roll Morton, who was at one time, of course, he called himself the originator of jazz and stomps in New Orleans. But in 1938, the years of his stardom were long over, and a lot of his songs, which had not been copyrighted, were hits coast to coast, made hits by the young white swing bands. Jelly Roll was working as a bouncer, a bartender, an impresario, and the entertainment at this dive bar called the Jungle Inn on U Street in Washington, D.C. I think Lomax realized then just how the copyright and publishing regimes could really leave original composers out in the cold. And when Goodnight Irene was turned into a hit in the mid-1940s by the Weavers, and money started coming in for the Weavers, of course, and not to Leadbelly, who had originally recorded the song for the Lomaxes in 1933, Lomax realized that it would be in his and the artists themselves in their best interest to get these songs copyrighted. And that was something that he was very proactive about throughout his career. All the records that he published of his recordings, the royalties were always split with the artists or the heirs of the artists. And up until today, part of our role with the Association for Cultural Equity is to make sure that any royalties generated by the music that Alan recorded of folks in the field go back to the families thereof or the artists themselves if they're still living.
Well, and I want us to listen to a bit of Jim Carter's song, Poor Lazarus. Nathan, can you set this up for us and just tell briefly the story of the royalties that Alan Lomax worked to eventually get to Jim Carter?
Sure. So the story is in 1959 at Parchment Farm, the Mississippi State Penitentiary, probably the site that Lomax recorded more than any other place. He returned there 5 times over the course of 25 years. He recorded a prison song, woodchopping song led by a fellow named James Carter called Poor Lazarus. In 2002, it appeared in the soundtrack of the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou film. And, of course, that record sold many, many millions of copies. And as royalties started to come in for that performance, we actually needed to hire an investigative reporter to try to track down James Carter, as we had no idea who he was or where he was. And he turned him up in the south side of Chicago. He had retired. He had gone to Chicago after being released from Parchment and worked for the GE factory there for a number of years, and he was retired. His wife was a deacon in a storefront church. We found her there. She had no idea that James Carter had made a recording in 1959, and he didn't remember. After we sent some audio and some photos that Alan had taken of Carter and said, well, you know, there's a movie and it's in this film, they obviously had no idea about that. A week later, they were on a plane for the first time. James Carter had never been on a plane to Los Angeles for that year's Grammy Awards. He, his wife, and his 3 daughters, where the record won Best Record of the Year. And we presented him with a rather sizable check. And he's been getting royalty payments ever since. He died in 2005, but his daughters continue to receive checks every quarter from us.
Well, and here is a bit of that song, which many of our listeners may recognize.
Oh, then lather, oh, then he cried, sister, oh, well, won't you turn me over slowly? Oh, well, lather, oh, yeah, cried, sister, won't you turn me over slowly?
Well, and that song and so many others are now available online. Bill, as you mentioned earlier, one of Alan Lomax's last projects was the Global Jukebox. Tell us about that.
Well, Alan had a capacious outreach for music, and he had 2 major projects called, one of which embraced music, the other dance, choreometrics and cantometrics, that mapped world culture around the globe through how people sang and danced. And then he moved on to a vision of a global jukebox that would empower people in every corner of the world with their musics being recorded and shared. And that was a concept that the internet today allows. I think a couple of thoughts in are the Seekers and the Lomaxes are two of the really the great families. And Charles Seeger and John Lomax worked together. And when Charles's son, Pete, became interested in music, Charles sent him to the Library of Congress to work with Allen, where Allen mentored him. And moving forward to O Brother, Where Art Thou, when we see that brilliant choreography of music, that is another Texan, T-Bone Burnett, who grew up as a teenager listening to Allen's recordings and later as a film music producer, brought those sounds from nowhere. People had never heard of Ralph Stanley singing O Death or of James Carter singing Lazarus, and they became best-selling sounds. So there's an arc of American music which Allen Lomax basically mined and brought these diamonds out into the public. And today they are common property of our heritage as Americans.
Bill Ferris is Senior Associate Director of the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC, and Nathan Salzberg is the Curator of the Allen Lomax Archive at the Association for Cultural Equity. Bill, Nathan, thanks so much for joining us on The State of Things today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
UNC Chapel Hill's Southern Folklife Collection is hosting the symposium The Southern Journey of Allen Lomax this Friday, February 22nd in Wilson Library at 5:30. Just ahead, author Ron Rash on his new collection of stories. Stay tuned.
Oh, that's all right, that's all right. That's all right, baby, that's all right.